This program is part of Film Geek Radio. Visit filmgeekradio.com for more great shows.
Hey Gumshoes, welcome to episode number 19 of Detect This here on Film Geek Radio. This is our podcast devoted exclusively to the HBO series True Detective. I'm Andrew Johnson, and unfortunately, I've got some bad news. Charlie is not with me today. Apparently, the Mexicans did not like his complaining, so they drove him out into the desert and left him to die. And by the time I realized what had happened, it was too late. I was thousands of miles away in Venezuela.
Well, Andrew, I hate to break it to you, but I've managed to find a way to communicate with you beyond the grave, so...
Oh my God, Charlie, you're alive, you're back!
It's a miracle, I know. I don't know if this is some sort of hallucination you're having, if I really am Charlie, or I'm all in your mind, Andrew, but I'm miraculously here.
Charlie, are you holding a baby? Were you pregnant?
Well... I in your mind I am, Andrew, I guess. I mean, I don't find that to be biologically possible, but Andrew, I do have a message for you, and it's please, I'm running late, but get on that boat. Don't make me get Felicia to force you on there.
Oh, wow. You know, it's true what they say, Charlie. Anything can happen in Venezuela. As always, our listeners can email the show at detectthis@filmgeekradio.com or leave us a voicemail by calling 336-793-2509. Be sure to subscribe to Detect This on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you leave us a positive iTunes review, we will make you an honorary member of the Detect This team. We don't have any new members to induct this week. We're going to save them to next week because, just like last season, we don't just stop podcasting when the season ends, you guys. We are going to do one last season wrap-up episode next week, hopefully with a very special guest, and we will be looking back over season two of True Detective as a whole, so be sure to tune in to that. Please send us a ton of emails, leave us your voicemails, leave us some more reviews, and we will go over all of that next week, just as our final send-off to this really weird season of television. But let's go ahead and dive right into today's episode. Today we are going to be discussing Season 2, Episode 8 of True Detective. This is the Season 2 finale. The episode is titled Omega Station, and it was written by Nick Pizzolatto and directed by John Crowley. As a reminder, this is not a spoiler-free podcast, so if you haven't seen the 90-minute finale, you need to go watch it and then come back and listen, because we are going to be spoiling everything that happened at the end of this season. But before we begin, Charlie, why don't you go ahead and remind our listeners what exactly went down on this season two finale of True Detective?
Well, Ray and Annie find Erica, Casper's secretary, and confirm that she and her brother Leonard killed Casper. Ray goes to the Anaheim Transportation Center to intercept a meeting between Leonard and Holloway, both of whom wind up dead. Frank recruits Ray into helping him take out McClandis and Osip so they can take their money and flee to Venezuela. Everything goes according to plan until Ray stops to say goodbye to his son, and Frank winds up kidnapped by the Mexicans. Burris and most of the police force track Ray into the woods, where they kill him. Frank loses his money, but refuses to give up his diamonds, so he's stabbed in the gut and left to die in the desert. Annie and Jordan make it to Venezuela, where they raise Annie's new baby and tell the whole story to a reporter.
All right, Charlie, this is it. The puzzle pieces are now all in place. It's been 8 episodes. Season 2 of True Detective has come to an end. You've seen this finale twice now.
I have. I watched it twice in one day, which is a big time commitment for a 90-minute finale.
Well, Charlie, what did you think of the finale of Season 2 of True Detective?
I hate to say it, Andrew. I thought this finale was a mess. I don't think it's without merit, but overall, it kind of sums up my feelings about the season as a whole, which was that it was just a misfire. Certain elements of it really disappointed me, and I don't think the performances were bad at all. In fact, I think everyone was acting their heart out, Vince Vaughn included, who I have not been exactly nice to over the past few episodes, but I feel like this finale was, as one critic put it, both too short and too long, and at times moved at a glacial pace, at others, had over-the-top violence for dramatic effect that didn't emotionally resonate with me. And as many answers as there are just as many questions that go unanswered. But what did you think?
I am mostly with you, Charlie. I think I might be a little bit more charitable because I think that there are some good ideas in this finale.
Yes.
Like, I can imagine Nick Pizzolatto sitting down at his typewriter or whatever he uses to write on.
He actually uses a quill. And yeah.
I can imagine him with quill and paper,
yep,
writing this down, just thinking, this is going to be amazing. There are good ideas here, Charlie, but I agree with you. The execution really bothered me. And there were a lot of scenes that I think could have been very, very effective and could have been very impacting, but because of the way that they were directed and or edited, just, it did not work.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I just want to make a note about, you mentioned the writing and the editing just now. I want to make note of that. John Crowley, who directed episode 5, which was Other Lives, he also did Boy A and the upcoming film Brooklyn with Saoirse Ronan, which is terrific. I do not blame any of the directors for the, to put it bluntly, bland take on this season, because I think overall, Cary Fukunaga got, for all the fights that he and Nick Pizzolatto had, Cary Fukunaga realized Nick Pizzolatto's vision and was able to convey it onto our screens in a very distinctive, very thrilling style, which is what I think this entire season lacked, in especially this finale. I feel like there's no flavor to it. There's no personality. It's just kind of there. And I can't imagine what John Crowley must have thought, along with all the other directors on this show, when they got the script and they had to, and it's this big convoluted mess, and thought, I don't know what style or what tone to go with here. So I want to say, I do think the execution is very flat and not executed well at all, but I almost feel sympathetic towards the people who were put in charge to put this on film, or on television, you know what I mean?
I do, and I'm sympathetic to a certain extent. However, I do think that it is fair to criticize some of the directing, especially because there were one or two scenes in this episode that I actually thought were directed very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of that contrast between these scenes that are handled really, really spectacularly, and then the rest, which is just kind of a mess.
Oh, God, yeah. And I'm not saying that everything was directed well here. There are some visual touches here that made me howl. So, yeah.
Right. So I think it's fair to criticize the direction with the knowledge that, yes, they probably had quite the task ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you want to start, Charlie? There's a lot to unpack in this finale.
Well, do you want to start from the beginning? Because I had a problem right off the bat with some dialogue that Annie and Ray exchanged to one another.
You know what? I think that's a great place to start because I actually disagree, Charlie, and I loved that scene.
Really?
Yes.
Again, I do not blame Rachel McAdams and Colin Farrell for the execution of this dialogue, but I found Annie's dialogue to be pretty offensive. And I'm saying this as a cis male. I've never been a victim of sexual assault. I'm not a woman, but Nick Pizzolatto wrote Annie in a way that she basically comes out and says, I was flattered because this child molester thought I was pretty. When, how old was she, Andrew?
Pretty young.
Pretty young. And it made her molestation subplot really not just ludicrous, but like, oh, I was flattered that he was pretty, so I let him molest me. I'm sorry, what?
I totally disagree with you, Charlie.
Really?
Totally disagree.
Totally.
Yes.
Wow.
I actually thought that that was a fantastic detail and really fascinating and really gets at this idea that in our society, women are socialized to believe that their looks are what matters most.
Absolutely.
And even children are socialized into believing that. So yes, I totally bought that a little girl, if a man said, you know, complimented her and said, "You're pretty," might go with him, especially if she grew up on this hippy dippy commune, you know, with no real rules. You know, I don't get the impression her dad was the type of person who spent a lot of time hammering into her head, "Don't get in a van with a stranger." You know, I get the impression this was the type of environment where, you know, everybody interacts with everybody. And yes, everybody's passing through and they're all on their own journey. So just get to know them. And I could totally buy that a little girl raised the way that Annie was would be flattered and go with this stranger.
It's not that I didn't buy the guilt of the molestation, because I know that's something that rape survivors deal with, is the, "I could have done something to prevent this," or "I, you know, it's my fault." You know, there's a lot of, and again, I've never been a victim of sexual assault, so maybe I'm out of my line here. I just found the writing to be like, oh, this is Nick Pizzolatto thinking, oh, this is what women think, right? Like, they must think this way. And I like your take on it. I wish the show did a better job of conveying that complex emotion that Annie felt, because I agree, you know, our culture completely objectifies women and completely puts that into our mindset, that a woman's looks are the most important part of her. But I just felt like it was so broad and so not, it was just it ended with the "think I'm pretty" type of thing. And then the conversation just ends, and it just made me think Nick Pizzolatto doesn't really understand the complex. It just made me feel like it was a very one-dimensional understanding of the female psyche for rape survivors, if that makes any sense.
See, I don't think it was very simple at all, because it was clear that Annie had not remembered his face until the party and had blocked most of this out of her mind. And it seemed to me like she was grappling with new knowledge. Like, oh my goodness, I remember his face. I remember why I got into the van with him, and I'm ashamed of that now in retrospect. And I love how it relates to what Ray tells her and what Ray confesses and saying, you know, "I killed this guy, and looking back, I should have said something. I wanted to say something. But in the moment, I didn't. And I didn't get a good look at him, and I just killed him." And I really like how you've got these two characters who are reflecting on the most horrible thing in their lives and are processing it and are opening up to each other about what happened and also about how they feel about it now and how messy they feel about it now.
I wish I had that thought in terms of how it was executed, because to play devil's advocate, even though I was like, I feel sympathy for whoever directed this, I feel like if it was executed in a way that gave me those thoughts, I would have liked it. But I felt like it was very, again, the writing's not great, so I just felt like it was kind of surface level psychology there. And in terms of your interpretation of it, Andrew, I totally wish I had that interpretation, because you're now making me, I'm not saying that I forgive the scene, I still stand by what I've said, but I wish I had those feelings, because I do think that's interesting in regards to these two characters and their relationship to one another. I just came off with Nick Pizzolatto is kind of trying to write something that he doesn't totally understand. And to be fair, I don't understand, but I've seen it done in much better ways that make me wish that he focused a little bit more on just the complexity of it. One thing I will say that I did find to be interesting is that the opening line of the episode is trees. And that's all that Rachel McAdams remembers is trees. And it was like a fairy tale. And not to jump too far ahead, but Ray's shootout ends in the woods, as you predicted last episode. And I did find that to be interesting that it kind of came full circle in that.
I found it interesting. I will say I thought the first few lines were awful.
Oh, no, there were. That's the thing is that I'm saying, that's the thing is I thought the first few lines were terrible. It was like a simplified version of this very complex issue that I do not have perspective on, but at the same time feel like it has been dealt with so much better. And
see, it wasn't even that. It was, I think that as the scene went on and I began to realize, okay, this is Annie talking about what happened to her, and then she opens up with Ray. I thought the scene really, really worked much better as it developed. But that opening, I was just like, oh my goodness, we're opening with this thing about, with this random comment about trees. How pretentious can you get, Nick Pizzolatto?
Well, I don't know if you know this, Andrew, but trees turn into paper, and those papers sometimes become contracts, and those contracts have signatures all over them, so.
Whoa, whoa. And also they become scripts with lines like that, that actors are supposed to read. Let's move on to our other couple, Frank and Jordan. Now, Charlie, you and I had a discussion last week about whether we thought Jordan was fully on Frank's side or whether it would turn out that she would betray him. Turns out she's totally on his side. How did you feel about her relationship with Frank and how that developed over the course of this episode?
I found a lot of that scene to be flat. And again, I think Kelly Reilly and Vince Vaughn did their best. I don't find the dialogue to be believable. Until my second viewing, there was one touch I liked. I thought the ring tossing the first time around was totally stupid. I was like, what does this have to do with anything? But when he throws out his ring and then Jordan throws out her ring, I found it to be interesting that his response was, that was a really big diamond. Because as we see at the end of the episode, Frank gets stabbed where he's, you know, holding the diamonds. And the diamonds are used by him to possibly close up the knife wound. And it was a huge metaphor for that. And I was just, I kind of helped but think like, oh, if only he had that diamond in his pocket, maybe, like, maybe that would have helped. But it's also the fatal flaw of Frank is that he chooses greed over love.
Yes.
As bad as the dialogue was, it was very clear that Jordan is right in front of him. He could get away. If he didn't decide to go on this killing spree with Ray and get $1 million or whatever, he could have gone on with Jordan, and that love that they had, as horribly, as despite the fact that there's no chemistry between them, as a character, that was the theme that I got out of Frank, is that he's misguided by financial growth in terms of emotional intimacy and his relationship with her. And there's the other line that the first time I laughed at, and then the second time I thought about a little bit, where Jordan basically says, you can't act for shit, take it from me. And at first I thought, oh, that's hilarious, it's breaking the fourth wall. But then I thought about how maybe I've been judging Vince Vaughn's performance all wrong, and he's acting badly in a performance that makes him a bad actor in terms of being intimidating or dealing with this stuff, and maybe he's playing the character as a bad actor.
I agree with you, Charlie. I like the line about the diamond that he cracks, and I love how that foreshadows his ultimate downfall. I'm going to disagree with you on the rest of this scene, though, Charlie. Again, I really liked that scene.
Really?
Yes, and here's why. It's sort of related to what you just said about Vince Vaughn. I like this idea that Frank, to a certain extent, in all his dealings, has to put up a front. And has to be rigid, and has to, in a sense, act. And the only person he can let his guard down with is Jordan. And I like how in this scene, again, maybe it's because he's still reeling from what happened with Blake, when Blake said everyone is against you. Maybe it's because he's worried about her safety, and maybe it's because he wants to be with her, but doesn't want to show her that, and he's afraid. And he's trying to hide it. I love how this scene, there's a lot of things going on. I think Frank is perhaps lying to himself about how he feels. I think he's trying to determine whether or not Jordan is also going to betray him. And I love how Jordan is just constant. Just like, no, I am with you. I'm with you. I'm with you. Like, no, you cannot get rid of me. And that really, really worked for me. And I actually think that they had a lot of fantastic chemistry in that scene. And we've seen movies like this before, Charlie, where the guy's like, no, you have to go.
Casablanca, for one.
Yeah, you have to go. You have to be safe. And usually it's just, it feels like a plot point that has to happen.
And that's what it felt like to me.
See, it didn't feel like that to me. It felt like, probably because it went on for so long, it felt like they were having an actual argument, an actual discussion, where they were actually gradually peeling back different layers of each other. And then they finally come to that agreement where Frank ultimately has to realize he can trust her and he can believe her. And Jordan has to realize that she can trust him when he says, I have to go do this.
See, I wish I was able to feel that way, but not only is Jordan brushed off to get on that get going type of stereotype where the male character says to his female love interest, just go, I'll be fine, just go. But what really made that scene curdle for me, especially during the second viewing, despite a few things I picked up on that were subtle, was that Annie, a main character of this season, is kind of reduced to the same thing. Colin Farrell, or Ray, basically tells her, you have to get on that boat. And it really bothered me that Nick Pizzolatto, in the finale of this season, reduced both of his female characters to basically people who the male characters had to say, you have to go. Trust me. It's all about my sacrifice. And I'm going to die, probably, but I'm lying to you. You have to go. And you probably don't believe me, but if you love me, you'll get on that boat. And it just made me think, ugh, like, really? Like, both of them?
I agree with you regarding Annie, Charlie, and I wish that she had played a bigger role in most of the action of this episode. Though, to be fair, she did save Ray's life.
That is one of the few parts of the episode I liked.
However, Charlie, I think Jordan came off as very strong in this episode, precisely because she is so determined and she is so repetitive in saying, no, no, I'm staying. I'm coming with you. And I honestly bought, like, if Frank said, all right, honey, here's a gun. Let's go take out McCandless. I honestly believed that Jordan would do it.
I would have preferred if that happened.
By the end of that scene, I totally believed she is committed to him and she will do whatever it takes. And I really, really liked that scene and that aspect of their relationship. And I'm really glad that they committed to that fully instead of having her turn out to betray Frank or something like that, because that would have been completely out of character.
I just feel like it's such a gender stereotype for the woman to be like, I'll stand by my man for anything and I will be strong, but I will give in even after a 5 to 10 minute scene of us. You see, she didn't come off as strong to me. She's still... Yeah, I appreciated that they took time to that for that, but she still gives in, Andrew. It still made me mad that she gives in and Annie gives in. They're basically serving the men in their lives because they feel like they owe them a debt, and that just didn't work for me.
I don't think so. I think Jordan gives in because she trusts Frank. Like, at first she's saying, no, 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 I have to go with you because she suspects he's going to leave her. Which, to be fair, he basically tells her.
He basically does, yeah. And she knows it. I know she knows it. There's no way, even if Nick Pizzolatto said I wrote the character believing this, it's clear through Kelly Riley's performance. She knows that Vince Vaughn isn't coming back.
Right. And I totally liked that scene. I liked their dynamic. I liked how they both seemed to evolve over the course of that argument. And even the over-the-top stuff, like throwing the rings, I thought, yes, that's totally what couples do when they fight. They do stuff like that.
That was the detail I liked. Yeah.
Yeah, and the scene just overall really, really worked for me.
That detail I liked, I just didn't like the outcome of the scene. I don't think that Jordan was especially a well-written character. I thought that Kelly Riley was completely wasted. I know I'm repeating myself by episode 8 of this 8-episode podcast. I wanted more out of her character than just, I'll stand by my man. Even when I'm strong, he will convince me to do what he wants.
Okay, well, let's move on to what happens later. Ray and Annie find Erica. They put the pieces together. They figure out that, oh, Lenny killed Casper. What did you think of all this?
Here's the thing, Andrew. When everything came together, I felt this is totally inscrutable. There is no way, unless you're paying super, super close attention to the fact that Lenny was in one scene in episode 3 on a movie set, that we would be able to figure this crime out ourselves.
It's Scooby-Doo!
But there's... Okay, Scooby-Doo is a cartoon that lasts half an hour per episode with commercial breaks. There is no possible way we could have figured all of this out on our own. And especially since they didn't reveal information to us by episode 5. And here's my devil's advocate thing. Even if we can't do that, even if we aren't able to put all the puzzle pieces together ourselves. Chris Ryan wrote a great piece for Grantland that came out earlier today, and he basically said, sometimes my favorite noir films are like this. Sometimes I can't explain the plot of it with a gun to my head, and that clarity is an overrated component of storytelling. If you asked me to explain The Big Sleep, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, neither could Raymond Chandler, famously.
But he also says, and I'm going to quote, this is a passage from his piece, what matters in crime fiction is feeling. It's attitude, atmosphere, dialogue, mood. It's the idea of one or more individuals going up against institutions of great power. It's the idea that the underworld exists right in front of you all the time, and you just have to look. I never got a vibe as to what I was supposed to be feeling, or what I was supposed to be invested in, or what I was supposed to be getting from this. I mean, what do you think about that?
I agree that a lot of the feeling is missing. And I think that's especially true of this plot point. You know, this is something that was built up in the first few episodes. Oh my goodness, who's the Birdman?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, who killed Casper? This was the inciting incident that started everything. And then it was really pushed aside for the majority of the rest of the season to focus on other conspiracies, which is okay. The problem with me, again, I think, is execution.
Mm-hmm.
The puzzle pieces are there. All this stuff about the two little kids growing up and seeking revenge, that works in theory.
And yet we weren't introduced to that until episode 6. So there was no way for us to know that information beforehand, which is a vital piece of the puzzle that Nick Pizzolatto left out, whether it was intentional or not, up until the 6th episode.
Right. I think the biggest problem for me is that Leonard was the killer, and Erica's description of him and how he behaves in this episode is completely different.
Yes.
From how I remember him behaving in episode 3 or whatever it was that we met him. He came across as a nice guy, as pretty calm, cool, collected. But no, according to Erica, he is just a mess. He's had a lot of trauma in his past, and he just goes off on Casper. And it happens again in this episode. He just attacks Holloway. It just feels too convenient. It mm-hmm. feels like Pizzolatto, as many things in this finale do, it feels like Pizzolatto was trying to put the pieces together, even though it didn't quite go with how he'd established characters in the past.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, Laura said he's a very troubled individual. She, in this episode, stated he's very impulsive, he's got this stuff. But first of all, I got a few weird plot. This is going to seem like nitpicks to some people, but okay, Ray and Annie find Laura handcuffed to the fireplace, and apparently Leonard forgot to lock the screen door. Like, what? I'm sorry, but like, they don't even have to break the screen door. If they broke the screen door, I can understand that. They just open the door, and she's there. And then on top of that, you know, Leonard's off to the side while Ray is interrogating Holloway, and he says, you looking for a wire? I don't have a wire. But you have a tape recorder. Like, what? That's so much more obvious. And I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit, so I apologize. But
no, please do, because that scene, or is this still about what happens in Anaheim in the transportation scene?
Yeah, and I have to admit, parts of that scene worked really well. I thought Colin Farrell was great. I thought the actor who played Holloway was great. I wanted to see more of that, but there were minor plot details like that. Like, who doesn't lock their door when they handcuff this person to the fireplace? And who says, I don't have a wire, when they really have a tape recorder? And then it all just played out so conveniently, and you're right. Leonard's actions to stab Holloway after Holloway admits that Casper was Laura's biological father and raised her illegitimately. He just stabs him like a maniac in public, and then conveniently Colin Farrell drops the tape recorder and it gets stepped on. It was just so far-fetched. I'm sorry.
Here's the thing, Charlie. I don't mind the door not being locked. I don't mind Ray having a tape recorder.
It's not the end of the world, but it was just jarring to me. I'm sorry. I know that's a nitpick.
Here's the thing. It's the big thing that bothered me. The huge revelation, okay? Holloway basically says Casper is the father of Leonard and Erica. So in this moment, Pizzolatto goes full Oedipus Rex. Like we've been theorizing, is he going to do it? Is there going to be some crazy murder or incest thing going on here? And yes, just like an Oedipus Rex, Leonard killed his father without knowing it.
And apparently Laura was fucking her father, I assume, if Casper was at all those sex parties.
Exactly. So Leonard finds out that when he killed Casper, he was actually killing his father. And he finds out that his sister might have been sleeping with their father. And that, to me, is a pretty big revelation. Again, this is the kind of thing that when it happens in Oedipus Rex, he gouges his eyes out and his wife hangs herself because they cannot deal with this knowledge. So it makes sense to me that Leonard would snap, but I guess, again, I never felt the weight of that knowledge. I mean, again, if he's an impulsive individual, it could have been something else that made him snap. You know, you never quite get the full weight of, oh my goodness, this guy accidentally killed his own, he killed his own father unknowingly, and his sister might have slept with him. That, to me, was just so mishandled.
Yeah.
At no point does Ray even tell Annie, hey, by the way, you know what's really messed up? Casper was their father. They never mention it again.
Well, she was there, so she might have heard it, but, like, the tape was destroyed, so she couldn't have heard it from that way. She was kind of a distance from them, so I'm not sure she could have eavesdropped on that. And on top of that, Laura doesn't find out this information, and we never care about her again. And the kicker, the cherry on top, is that as soon as this shit happens, the worst visual in the entire season for me was Lara Lynn's song starts playing, and Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams start running in slow motion away from the scene. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Here's what needs to have happened in that scene. Leonard somehow needs to have escaped. He needs to be the one running in slow motion, tears streaming down his face.
Exactly!
Full of anger and frustration and confusion about what the hell he has just discovered.
Yep.
Okay, I'll give you another. You know what it made me think of, Charlie? Another movie that definitely borrows from Oedipus Rex. Spoiler, sorry if you're listening to this, don't mean to spoil this great movie for you. But Old Boy.
Yep, I thought of Old Boy as well.
If you go see Old Boy, dear listeners, make sure you watch the Korean version, not the American version. But oh my goodness, Charlie, when there is that climactic scene at the end, again, it feels shocking. It carries legitimate emotional weight, and the character just cannot cope.
Yep. I don't want to spoil about how he cannot cope with that, but it makes sense because in Old Boy, the protagonist, we've been through his perspective, his singular perspective throughout the entire film, and all the clues add up to something that is emotionally resonant to the climax of the film. Here, we have a bunch of characters who we don't know. Leonard, we've seen once in a previous episode, never seen him again up until this finale, which he takes about maybe 15 minutes of screen time of. And that's the thing, that goes back to my inscrutability thing. We would have never been able to find this out on our own. And sure, maybe at the beginning of Old Boy, you don't know who his kidnapper is or whatever, but they give you hints and they give you flashbacks in a way that makes it feel like you're discovering this with the protagonist, with flashbacks that he blocked out, going back to Annie, that feel coherent in terms of its storytelling. Here, Nick Pizzolatto introduces a bunch of characters that we don't know and are basically told how they are, as opposed to shown how they are, and then expects us to have some sort of emotional catharsis out of it, and I was just kind of like, well, that wrapped up.
Right, and again, Charlie, I feel like, in theory, there's nothing wrong with the facts of the puzzle. There's nothing wrong with those facts. It's the way they are structured and the way they are executed that rob them of the necessary emotional weight.
Exactly.
I mean, if you're going to borrow from Oedipus Rex, you need to understand that Oedipus Rex is all about blindness to the truth, and then when you realize the truth is so horrible, it drives you insane. none of those emotional stakes were communicated in this scene. And it almost felt like a detail that was just thrown in, kind of like Pizzolatto going, oh, I'm gonna reference Oedipus Rex.
Yep.
And we're gonna have a quick line about how, yep, Casper was their father. Boom, done. And I'm like, no! You can't just do that with a plot point like incest and murdering someone's father. You can't just toss it in there and then move on.
I don't want to know the people who committed incest before the incestual twist is introduced. I need to know who these people are. And to be fair, I actually thought that Colin Farrell looked badass in those aviators and cowboy hat. And I actually thought before Leonard stepped in, it was pretty well done. I thought that was really suspenseful. And then the payoff is just so absurd that I just threw my hands up in the air and started laughing.
This is how personally I think it could have been done better, Charlie. And I know it's not cool to say, well, here's how I would have done it. But
it's okay. I've done it too.
I'm imagining what would have happened if this had all been written a little bit differently, where what if Ray and Annie realized we need to use Erica and Leonard to get what we want.
Using them as pawns, and then the sacrifice of their mortality would impact them as characters. They could not give less of a shit that those characters are dead at the end of the scene.
Like, what if Ray and Annie go to Leonard's house, they find Leonard and Erica, they sit down and they talk, and they say, hey, we want the same thing. We want justice / revenge for what's going on. How about we all team up and we work this out and we get the dirt that we need to blow this wide open? And they go and everything's going according to plan. And Leonard and Erica are both there. And it seems like things are going well. And then suddenly, bam, Holloway drops the knowledge that Casper was their father. And then things unravel. I feel like if Leonard and Erica were more active participants.
Not introduced 6 episodes in.
Well, even if they are, just make them active participants in the scene where we're as equally invested in, oh man, what are they going to do versus what are Ray and Annie going to do? Then when that knowledge arrives, it actually affects them, you know, and ruins the plan somehow. But yeah, it was really, really poorly executed and probably the worst part about the finale to me.
Well, it was also, for as convoluted and confusing as this season has been, this was the most insanely predictable part of the finale. Like, I don't know anyone who was genuinely surprised by this outcome. And in terms of the whole Casper was really their father revelation, who gives a shit? I'm sorry to be harsh, but, like, we all saw this coming. I'm not...
Well, that's the thing. Leonard gives a shit, and Erica gives a shit. So, somehow, write this episode, if you're not going to restructure the whole season, you know, at least rewrite this episode so that they play a more important role. And so that we are actively invested in them, and how they behave and how they act in this scene directly impacts Ray, Annie, and whether or not they're going to be able to blow this thing wide open.
Yeah, but it doesn't really have much of an impact on them. Not really.
Exactly. That's because of how the scene was written.
Yep.
I did think it was kind of funny that Holloway got shot by one of his own guys. Thought that was appropriate. And let's be honest, not to sound insensitive, but in this day and age, when a white guy fights with a black guy, cops shoot the black guy.
Okay, because you went here, I want to target something, and I know this is not exactly in order of everything, but I want to just say, Andrew, you mentioned before that Vince Vaughn's racist comments affect Vinci as a form of racist corruption, and I just want to say flat out, I think this show is, or this season at the very least, is racist, because Vince Vaughn continues to make racist jokes throughout this episode, such as to the mayor's wife, oh, I hope that Miss Ukraine money helps pay this off. Call someone a kike motherfucker. And then in the dream sequence, when he's dying towards the end, is bullied by a bunch of black and Latino actors for some reason that makes sense to Nick Pizzolatto, but just felt like racist stereotyping to me. And I really wanted to say this season felt racist as fuck. And all the characters of color either die or are collateral damage or, it just made me really angry. So I want to hear what your take is on this.
I have mixed feelings about it. I think ultimately I'm willing to go with it just because Frank seems like the kind of person, like, of course he's going to feel that way and refer to people just by their ethnicity.
But what commentary does that make? You know what I mean? Like, what is that saying? Or is that just Nick Pizzolatto throwing in racist jokes for racist jokes' sake?
No. I think it seems appropriate to his character. And it seems appropriate to, I think, the style of noir that Pizzolatto is trying to pay homage to with that character. Of just the Anglo-Saxon crime boss, you know. We did actually get an email. I was going to save this to the end of the episode, but now it kind of seems appropriate to go over now. We got an email from a listener named Liz, who actually wrote in about this very issue. And she writes, quote, "I originally thought Frank was being racist, but someone pointed out to me that he is living in a racist world of criminals. He's fitting in and saying what must be said in that community of thugs. It's like the characters on Orange is the New Black. They socialize by race."
But Orange is the New Black deals with race in a much better way than True Detective Season 2 is. The thing about True Detective Season 2 is that all of its ideas are put into a blender and just thrown into this ridiculous hodgepodge of scattershot ideas to the point where it comes off like the themes on racism, if they're intended, don't come off well, as in, this is a racist society to me, it more comes off with, oh, that was a racist joke. And I'm not saying that I need a commentary hit over the head, but at the same time, it just feels sour to me. In addition to that, to go back to Inherent Vice, which we've mentioned before, Michael Kenneth Williams plays a character named Tariq Khalil in Inherent Vice, who's black, and the actor's black, and his race isn't mentioned at all. So I don't think that it doesn't matter what racial descent he's from. And it just felt like Nick Pizzolatto shorthanding himself in terms of if he was trying to make some sort of commentary on racism, it just came off as plain racism to me.
That's fair. Moving on. So Frank and Ray decide to team up and go take out Osip and McCandless. And that scene just fell flat to me.
Same here. Because there's no emotional stakes. We don't know who these people are that they're shooting up. I mean, we've seen them a few times, but that doesn't mean we know who they are in terms of their characters.
See, that part didn't bother me. I thought there was a nice moment when Frank sees Osip and says something to the effect of, oh, I guess it was today, you know, that I was going to...
That I didn't have a problem with, but what I did have a problem with was him saying, you're like a son to me. I'm like, we haven't seen none of that. That is such a cliche for when someone who was raised under a gangster's wing is about to be killed. You're like a son to me. It's a cliche that can be pulled off well. It did not here.
Well, here's why it worked for me, is because clearly Frank had a pretty awful relationship with his father. So that's not the thing you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to compare yourself to Frank's father. So that worked for me overall. To me, it was the direction of the action.
Yeah.
It just felt very standard, very cliche. Oh, there's going to be a few people shot, and there's going to be some smoke, and that's it.
Yeah.
And it was not that intense. You know, they built it up like, oh, this is the big thing they have to do. They are going to have to infiltrate this meeting and take out a bunch of guys,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't seem that hard.
It's just a bunch of similar shots of Vince Vaughn with an automatic weapon just blowing the shit out of people amidst tear gas. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that you pointed out about, you know, don't mention Frank's father, because to be completely honest, I kind of forgot about that until now.
You're right, and I think that's probably why Frank pulls out the other gun to use on him.
And shoots him like 17 times.
Yes, like, yeah. I'm just gonna, like, forget this assault rifle or whatever he's carrying. I'm just gonna pull out this thing and empty the clip into you because of what you just said.
That would have been great if it just cut to Colin Farrell in a close-up going, oh shit, and then him just pulling out that pistol and
you
blasting him
not
away.
You said
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that scene I didn't think was particularly well directed. Of course, afterwards, you get this scene of Ray smiling, looking genuinely happy for the first time in the whole season. in the car when he's talking to Annie on the phone. And that's when I knew, bye, Ray. You're not going to make it to Venezuela.
We all predicted this a week ago. Even though we didn't know exactly how it was going to play out, we knew the outcomes of all these characters.
Yes, but that confirmed it for me. That when he was so happy, I was just like, okay, that's how these things go. Character's really happy, and then it all goes to hell.
Yeah, that's a minor detail I didn't notice, I have to admit.
And I have to tell you, Charlie, though, again, it's one of those things, in theory, I'm okay with Ray being killed off. I hated how it was executed.
It was so stupid! I'm sorry, but it was so stupid.
I don't mind the fact that he goes to see his kid one last time. That doesn't bother me.
That is a contrivance I am willing to buy because they have built it up throughout the season. Can I also stop you for a second and say, though, that the scene that emphasizes their last glance at one another I thought was terrible?
See, that didn't bother me either. Here's what bothered me. When he sees that his kid brought the badge to school with
him,
I was like, no, 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 no. I see what you're going for, Nick Pizzolatto. You're trying to show that, look, the kid is Ray's son, and he knows it, and he's proud of his dad, and looks up to him, and it's all supposed to be thematically relevant. I get that, but I'm sorry. That kid would not take that badge to school. Not after he's been bullied the way he has.
Exactly. And aren't they playing like Dungeons and Dragons or some board game or something? I'm like, yes. That is bully fuel. That is straight up bully fuel. It's also Chekhov's badge. Like, it was so bluntly introduced 5 episodes ago or whatever that I just groaned when that came on sight. And then they look at each other, and I thought it might be emotionally, maybe I can overlook the badge thing. Maybe this will be emotionally poignant. And the son salutes to him, and Colin Farrell salutes back to him, and I'm like, was this scene ghost-directed by Michael Bay? Like, what am I watching right now? Like, where is the salute coming from?
That all worked for me. It was just the fact that the badge was there. I was like, come on. And then when he goes back to his car, and I was trying to figure out, like, wait, is that a bomb? And then only later I realized it was a transponder. And really irritated me that he did not cut it off.
There's also a puddle underneath his car where I don't know where that water came from because the rest of the street is completely dry, and the only way he could tell that it was attached was because there was the red light reflected through the water.
I thought that it was fuel. I thought it was fuel too
until, like, it wasn't. Like,
I thought they had cut the gas and this was a bomb. And it's all supposed to explode.
That's what I thought, too. As soon as he gets in the car and puts the key in the ignition, he's going to blow up like the opening scene of Casino. I thought that was exactly what was going to happen. And then, no, it's a transmitter that tracks where he is. Not to mention, didn't they just wipe out everyone in that fucking cabin? Like, you think, and then he happens to be, who's the cop? I'm sorry.
Burris?
Yeah, that Burris so happens to be at Colin Farrell's son's school, he just happened to know that he couldn't resist. I mean, we as viewers know this. I don't know this character at all. So it just came off as such a contrivance, like, he happened to know Colin Farrell was gonna somehow stop by beforehand. It was so contrived and far-fetched.
Well, here's the other thing, Charlie. He doesn't cut off the transponder because he says, oh, they'll track me back to you, Annie.
So no, they won't.
See you. And I'm like, okay, fine. You wanna leave Annie on her own. You wanna tell her to get on the boat on her own. Fine. You still cut off the transponder.
Yeah.
They cannot directly track you, and maybe you can lose them. I mean,
yeah, and as cold-blooded and insensitive as this is, just put it on another car. There were so many cars parked near him, and I feel bad for whoever is the result of that, but it at least would have made sense to me, you know?
And that's what Annie tells him to do.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, I can't do it. I'm like, they'll still follow me. And I'm like, yeah, they'll still follow you, but you have a better chance of escaping, you moron. And so, oh my goodness, I hated how that all went down.
Same here.
I hate how he winds up in the woods. I'm like, yes, of course he's going to wind up in the woods.
You called that last week.
Yeah, and it's like, that's what his father had said in his dream when he went into limbo or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my God, he's trying to send the voicemail, And the last moment, he looks up at the trees, and it's all beautiful. And I was just like, oh my goodness, how cliche can you get?
Yeah, it's like out of a Terrence Malick film. Like,
here's the thing. I think, again, with more competent direction in this scene, I think it could have worked. I was thinking back to the moment in season one when Rust and Marty are in the corridors of Carcosa in the finale. They're tracking Errol, and Rust stumbles upon just that pillar of light, and he looks up and he has that vision.
Oh, that's a great point. I completely forgot about that.
And that's right when Errol stabs him, mm-hmm. shoots him, whatever yep. happens. And I was thinking, come on, this is your opportunity to call back to that and to tie it together a little bit visually. But no, he's just going to look up in the trees, and then he's going to jump out and get shot.
So stupid. Can I interrupt? I'm sorry. That was just so stupid. He's shot and killed two of them. There's only three of them left, or right? Isn't there like three?
I couldn't tell, but here's the other thing, Charlie, I was thinking, why is he doing this?
Right! He has a way to survive! He had cover! And then, like, they just yell, where's Bezzarides? And then he says, in a better place, and then jumps out in plain view of everyone and gets shot, like, 17 times, as if the amount of times he gets shot is gonna have a bigger emotional impact for us as viewers. It was so dumb.
Okay, but not even that, Charlie. I was thinking, why is he running at all if he just thinks he's doomed? Like, obviously, Burris is corrupt. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Burris wants him dead. But is the whole police force corrupt? Like, if he were to toss out his gun and say, I surrender, take me into custody, would they kill him?
I assume so, but you're right. I mean, like, that's another good point. I mean, Annie's partner clearly isn't corrupt. I called that he would be corrupt, and that didn't happen this episode, remember? And also, another thing, just to add on to that, her sister and her creepy cult-like father add up to nothing, for whatever reason. And, yeah, like, it doesn't make any
right.
sense.
Like, assuming Burris doesn't have direct control over everybody out there, mm-hmm. and Burris has directly told them, even though it's against the law, just shoot him on sight, even if he surrenders.
Even though he has no problem pinning the murder of Woodrow onto Colin Farrell, despite the fact that the rest of the cops did their jobs and saw that the bullet came from Burris's firearm, they would probably be able to convict him.
Right.
There was no, like, I'm going to put my fingerprints, I'm going to put Colin Farrell's fingerprints on this weapon and make it seem like it's his. Like, there was none of that. It was so messy.
All I was thinking was, all right, Ray, just surrender. And if someone shoots you, like if Burris shoots you after you've surrendered, surely at least one other policeman will go, huh, that was not cool.
That's
not procedure. I know he supposedly killed a cop, but no, that's not how we do things. Like, really, is the entire police department that corrupt? It just so many little things about the way Ray went out just really bothers me.
On top of that, you cut to Rachel McAdams, who you cut to her bawling. As soon as Ray dies, she starts sobbing her eyes out and turns into a blubbery mess. And this is the second episode in a row where I'm like, oh, Nick Pizzolatto writes women as if they have the psychic ability to tell when their male lover has been shot. Like, it was so, ugh, give me a break. Like, really? Twice in a row? Twice in two episodes? Seriously, Pizzolatto? Ugh, it was stupid. I'm sorry.
I want to contrast how Ray goes out with how Frank goes out.
Okay.
The way Frank goes out, I have issues with, but I am far more on board with, at least conceptually. I like the idea that they've got the money, everything is going fine, and then, of course, one of the deals that Frank has made over the course of the first half of the season finally comes back to bite him.
And he doesn't know. He completely forgets. He says, why, as they're aiming a gun at him in face, at like point blank. And I have to admit, I forgot about it, but the character shouldn't. Like, he should know. Oh, yeah, I burned down the clubs, and the Mexicans said they wanted a good slice of whatever profit I make out of them. He was
right.
Totally clueless.
I'm fine with that in theory. I'm fine with him taking him out to the desert. And actually, I really love the scene where he's walking through the desert, bleeding out. I think that given how Frank was underdeveloped in terms of what we know about him, and given how we know very, very little about these visions that he's seen, I thought it was filmed beautifully. I thought it was edited well. I thought Vince Vaughn killed it in that scene.
I agree. I think Vince Vaughn acted his heart out, and I have been far more harsh than you have in terms of his performance.
Like, every time he popped up and was just walking and was just, like, talking to himself and just motivating himself to continue, I was just like, you go, Vince Vaughn. I am totally rooting for you, Frank. Mm-hmm. You could pull this off. And I love how it turns out he's imagining that he's still walking, and that's all a mirage. I thought that was all handled very, very well.
It was a powerful image. It was beautifully shot. The cinematography of the desert is gorgeous. I agree. The things that I have problems with is that it becomes a dreamlike David Lynchian type of thing, where it hasn't been that at all, but he's dying, so I'll give it that benefit of the doubt.
Here's what doesn't work for me about his death, and it really bothered me at first until I figured out what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets stabbed because he won't give over his suit, I was like, what the hell
yeah.
is going on? Like, what?
I thought that too.
Are you that petty, Frank? Like, what? Why are you getting so concerned about your suit?
Yep.
And it was only later that I realized, oh yeah,
the diamonds. Yeah.
Yes, the diamonds were in the suit pocket. He wanted to keep the diamonds. And again, it's exactly like what happened with everything with the incest,
mm-hmm.
where I was kind of like, okay, I understand what you're going for, and I think this is good in concept. In execution, it did not have the weight it needed to have. And I had forgotten about the diamonds.
Yep, I did too.
And the fact that, again, this is Frank's fatal flaw. We've talked about this before. All Greek heroes, at least in tragedies, have a fatal flaw, usually pride or hubris. And that's what Frank has. He's greedy. He can't just let it all go. He has to keep and take whatever he can, including those diamonds. And if they had sold that moment more, and they had reminded me, oh yeah, the diamonds are in his pocket, and this is the key moment for Frank, where he has to decide, which do I value more, my life or my diamonds?
Mm-hmm.
If they had sold that moment, and it had really, they had just hammered home, this is his fatal flaw that's about to doom him, I think that scene would have worked perfectly.
That's the thing about the whole season, is that Nick Pizzolatto expects you to remember certain things that haven't been detailed well. So I agree. The first time around, I was like, well, that's stupid. And then as soon as it cut to the diamonds in his wound to clog up the blood that was draining out of his body, I was like, okay, that makes sense. It's a heavy-handed image, but I'll take it.
Right. And then I was like, oh, I guess he didn't just care about the suit.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Like, but I was so mad when he got stabbed, because I was like, why? I don't understand where is this coming from with the character. And then it was only later that I was like, oh, okay, I see what they were going for.
Mm-hmm. But, like, even a quick shot of the diamonds, like, a 0.5-second shot of, like, the diamonds, like, somehow, like, if it did a Three Kings thing where it did an X-ray or something, even something it would have been completely stylistically out of touch with the rest of the season. But even, like, some visual reminder to remember that they're there.
Or even if he tried to talk his way out of it, like, hey, mm-hmm. you want my pants? I like this jacket. I want to keep the jacket, but you can have the pants, or, you know.
No, instead he decides to just completely shove him in front of the rest of his gang and get stabbed. It was so impulsive that I agree. I was completely lost. Here's the thing. I liked everything in that scene except, and I mentioned this before, what the fuck was up with those, people of color just name-calling him? And at one point, they just say horribly offensive things like, what, you fucking retarded or something? And I'm like, okay, I understand who the father is and who Jordan is, but who are these people?
They're from Chicago. He's from Chicago, remember?
Yeah, but did the Chicago come where does every black person or person of color in Chicago a racial stereotype? That just felt so unintentionally offensive to me. Like, why did all of them have to be black or Latino, Andrew? Why couldn't it have been a bunch of mixed races or white people? And I know I'm getting social justice warrior on you here, but it just felt like, well, that feels racist. I mean, didn't you feel a little icky about that?
No, because I felt like this is Pizzolatto trying to remind us, oh yeah, Frank is originally from Chicago, he got his start in crime there. He probably interacted a lot with the African American gangs there, and this could have been what happened. And that didn't bother me.
It really bothered me.
The reason that part didn't work for me is just because I think, like everything with Frank's father, we've only gotten little hints.
Yep.
And little reminders. So when they do show up at the end taunting him, it doesn't have quite the impact I think it could have if that had been a little bit more developed throughout the season. But even so, it was shot so well, and Vince Vaughn's performance was so spectacular.
He was great. He was great. I will give him that. Yeah.
He carried it. Like, I think if his performance had been lacking, everything would have just fallen apart. I would just would have been like, who are these people? Why do I care? But he sold it. He carried that entire sequence on his shoulders.
Yeah. No, I wish I could give that scene to him, because even the father, again, we've only heard about him, but at least I could tell, okay, that's his father. It just felt so... where is this coming from? It didn't help that Frank made racist comments throughout the entire season that just made me think, is Nick Pizzolatto racist and he doesn't realize it? Like, is he doing this? And again, that's a directorial decision and casting decision and everything like that. But Jordan and the father, fine. Who the fuck are these people? Why are they talking like stereotypes? Is everyone from Chicago, you know, a stereotypical, like, verbally assaulted gang that is all of people of color? It just felt really sour to me. You know what I mean? It completely took me out of the scene and made me think, whoa, this is fucked up. Where is this coming from? Is this supposed to be some sort of commentary? Oh, not really. Okay, that's fucked up.
All right. Anything else you want to say about this episode, Charlie?
Well, yeah, we didn't really get to talk about Annie. Here's a thing that I wanted to talk about, actually, Andrew. This is the... okay, last week I didn't really have a foot... I lost my foot to stand on in terms of why Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams' relationship felt weird to me. And I was talking to a friend of mine who said, remember back in, like, episode 3 or 4... where Michael Hyatt, who played Catherine Davis, basically said, oh, you don't have to sleep with him, but you should make him think you should sleep with him. And it started off as a really, like, this is a jab at sexism in the workplace. This is how women have to deal with their male partners in the workplace. And I thought Nick Pizzolatto was really going for something with this. And then realizing that fact made their whole relationship really curdle for me. And then Annie, who is arguably the most pivotal character of the season, be sidelined off to just worrying, calling Colin Farrell over the phone and crying at the exact moment he died, just made me think, oh, she's now just a cliched love interest. Who, by the way, has his baby, which made me furious. It was so... ugh, like, not only does Colin Farrell... but not only, I mean, Colin Farrell never realizes it, but not only does Abigail Spencer, who plays his wife, his estranged wife, get a test result that says 99.99% chance that that ginger kid is his son. He has now two sons, and Annie feels it's a debt to both of his sons to do this, not because she's been swept up in this corruption, not because she may be ruined as a person, but because she feels like she owes it to her male partner who she conveniently fell in love with, like, an episode before the whole season ended. And that just made me think, fuck you, Nick Pizzolatto, you still don't know how to write women. All the feminist shit that you were working on built up to this point means nothing. And Kelly Riley's wasted, and you ended the show as soon as it started getting interesting, where they're a quasi-family, and fuck this season. It made me really mad.
It irritated me, but I wasn't even thinking about it in those terms, Charlie. I think what irritated me was that Ray didn't even get one little victory.
Oh, see, but that's the thing that doesn't bother me. He got so many victories from beyond the grave from everyone, and
right,
it wasn't
the,
even...
but it's the fact, yeah. But it's the fact that he can't enjoy it. Like, the fact that he... and I understand this is going back to the whole Greek tragedy thing. It all has to end horribly.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he didn't find out that it was his son. He didn't even get to send the voicemail. You know, and I think that was the one that really annoyed me. Like, really? Really? The universe is so conspired against Ray that the voicemail's not even going to send.
See, that's the one instance where it was a plot contrivance where I was like, this is really emotionally manipulative, but I'll buy it. So it's funny that we're having polar opposite reactions to emotionally manipulative plot points here, because I did not mind that, because I felt like Ray got so much honor from beyond the grave for not really going back and correcting any of his former terrible choices. It was just that he happened to fall in love with Bezzarides for whatever fucking reason Nick Pizzolatto thought would feel legitimate. And I bought your theory before about, like, they could die tomorrow, they might as well be fucking. I'm like, okay, I'll let that go. But then she's just in love with him. Like, where does that come from?
I buy that just because based on the strength of the opening scene. The fact that they were so, they've shared that with each other, their deepest, darkest secrets. So that part worked for me.
Too little, too late for me.
I agree with you. Like, honestly, why was the scene with Abigail Spencer even included?
Because it was meant to add to the tragedy that, oh, he really was his son. Aww.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. It's meant to give a little bit of extra satisfaction to the viewer. That's it. It has no relevance to any of the characters. Ray's not around to figure it out. Annie's not around to figure it out.
Although Annie does figure it out because she uses the word sons as in plural, not like son.
Well, I guess she just knows he had a son.
Because Annie's apparently psychic, as I've mentioned before.
No.
Whatever.
I mean, she would take the view that regardless of who the father is, Chad is his son.
Okay, Chad. I kept forgetting his fucking name. It's Chad.
Regardless of who the biological father is, she would say Chad is his son because he raised him. But I was just thinking, nobody needs to know this. None of the other characters in the show know this information.
Nope.
So why are you showing it? And it really is, like you said, Charlie, just to, like, make the viewer feel a little bit better about Ray.
It's emotionally manipulative. For the sake of being emotionally manipulative to us as viewers, it has no emotional significance to any other characters in this series. Todd Vanderwerf wrote about how, basically, the characters, none of them are really emotionally invested in this crime in this season. And to be fair, I understand what Pizzolatto's going for. But it was never when I was watching episodes of the show where I got where he was going for. I've had to think about it over time and read several reviews and get, if I can get clearer answers through write-ups of this show than what Nick Pizzolatto can convey to me on the screen, that's a problem. And it's not that, like, oh, it's thought-provoking and I have to let this linger with me type of thought. It was basically, okay, it's finally over, and then I go online and read other people's takes, and I thought, you know, that's a good point. Not that the program itself left me with these thought-provoking possibilities, you know?
Right. And ultimately, the final scene of this finale, it felt very tacked on. It felt like, oh, we need to have some sort of happy ending. It felt like we need to have some sort of hope. Because again, the ending of season one was surprisingly optimistic.
Which a lot of people complained about, too.
I thought it worked fine because
I did too. Yeah,
it was related to the arc of those characters, and I thought that it managed to pull it off, and it felt surprisingly organic. Here, it feels very tacked on. We've had these horrible deaths. Annie and Jordan barely escape, but it's supposed to be like, oh look, she has a baby, so Ray's gonna live on through him, and oh look, she somehow convinced a reporter to fly to Venezuela.
That was Nails. That was Nails, who's not getting paid anymore for this,
assume. No. That wasn't Nails.
Wasn't it Nails?
No, that was a reporter.
I read one review that said it was Nails. There are so many fucking characters in this season that I've forgotten who Nails was.
Nails is my new favorite character, and I'm going to tell you why. Nails is the guy that we made fun of because he said that Osip was, whatever, the cross between the anaconda and the shark. Okay?
Oh, whoops. Okay, that's totally my fault.
That's Nails. And I just want to point out, he's played by actor Chris Kersen. And I believe I said in that episode, I could not decide if that was the best acting on True Detective or the worst. Because in that scene, you know what? It has to do with his face. His facial structure is so unique. You can never quite tell if he looks serious or slightly deranged. Or maybe high?
Well, it's probably because he got a copy of the script and he's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. Like,
but something about Chris Kersen's face and just his eyes, it grew on me over the season where I was just like, this guy is weird and I like it. And the fact that he ultimately was Frank's most loyal henchman, the guy that stayed true to him even to the end, I really liked that.
Yeah.
Just that it was this random, really weird person. And I'm pretty positive that was not him at the end. No, no, he did walk out of the hotel. He did walk out of the hotel with Annie and Jordan. He's still with them.
See, that's a big problem, too. I've gotten all these characters' names confused, and everyone has first and last names in a way that didn't pay off unless they were, like, of a different ethnicity where they were referred to as Mexicans or Russians or whatever.
My understanding is, no, she's turning over these documents and she's told her story to this reporter because he says something like, well, I don't know if I can take this to the Times or something like that. And she's hoping that the story is going to get out.
Yeah, but it, what really bothered me is, like, do it for yourself, Annie and Jordan. Don't do it because you say, I owe a debt to him and his sons. Like, no, you were framed in this crime, too. Don't feel like you owe it to Colin Farrell because you saved his life last time. If you want to keep score here, didn't she save his life more than he saved hers? Because when you come down to it, as you mentioned, the transmitter would, like, track him to her? Not really. Not in a... That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to you, does it?
Also, why is Jordan not also there? She's in the other room watching the baby. And I'm like, wait, wait, Jordan has valuable information. Was she already interviewed? Don't you want to get her take?
And not to mention, you gave the wrong female character a child at the end. All Kelly Riley's been talking about is wanting a kid. Don't just make her be the babysitter. That's so demeaning. Like...
Ray wins everything, basically. He doesn't just have one kid. He has
exactly.
Two.
And your complaint about him saying, oh, he didn't even get his voicemail to his son, is nullified for me because he gets so much in the afterlife in terms of a legacy that I don't really... That nullified the whole tragedy, the whole emotionally manipulative but effective shot of the phone going, voicemail failed to send. Because, let's face it, it was more important for him to say it than it was for the son to receive it. So I got that.
That's true. I think... What really bothers me about the voicemail is just that it's so awkward. We've all been there, Charlie. We've all been trying to send it.
Oh, yes.
While we do something else. It's the fact that it's in the middle of this life or death situation where he's like, come on. I gotta get a signal so I can send this thing while I try not to get shot. That it came across as unintentionally funny.
Yeah.
Rather than emotional to me. And then when... Ultimately, it didn't send. I was just kind of like, wait, you're going to include this goofy thing and it's not even going to pay off.
Exactly. It was goofy and worked for me in the moment. That scene, I will admit, as manipulative and hokey as it was, worked for me in the moment. By the time you learn that everything everyone's doing is in his honor and not in, like, apparently Woodrow just gets a highway named after him. Nobody cares about that after him after that.
I was wondering about that. I was like, wait, why is he getting a highway? And then I realized, oh, they have to cover up what happened and make it seem like he was shot by Ray and he's really a hero.
Yeah, and there's a shot of Emily in the background. Emily doesn't even get her own personal shot. She just has a baby at his funeral and the unveiling of the sign. And I guess his mom, who the fuck cares? But here's what I will say. As much as I've been very negative towards this finale, I will say the same thing that I said about Vince Vaughn to Colin Farrell. He was given some shit dialogue, even though I didn't buy it. I was very close to, because even though Colin Farrell has been criticized of having this Christian Bale gravelly voice, I felt like Colin Farrell was always giving it 100%. Even in the worst, most annoying scenes of the show to me, where I complained about his character, I always felt Colin Farrell's heart was in it. And I feel like even if he knew that his dialogue was ludicrous, he never was winking at the camera. He always sold this very cliched cop to me.
All right, last thing I do want to say, Charlie, kind of getting back to what you were saying about the female characters, mm-hmm. I think you could make a case that the strongest female character in this episode is Felicia, the scarred waitress.
Really, though? But she's in debt to Colin Farrell, too. She's in debt to Ray, too. He's like, I owe him a debt because he arrested the guy who cut me up, so I owe him. He wasn't strong at all.
No, but she's the person who is actually... actively trusted. Like, she's the one who actively has to make sure that Annie gets on the boat. She's the one that sets Frank up with the safe house. She's going to take over the club after he's gone. They've kind of been hinting that maybe she had feelings for Ray, and so...
I didn't get that, but I'm not gonna discredit that theory.
They shared some glances whenever he came to the
bar. I mean, I guess.
And yes, and here we find out that it's because he got the guy that scarred her face. So that's why she has this bond with him. But I thought it was interesting. I found myself wondering, like, oh, does she have a crush on him? How does she feel about Annie and the fact that they're together now? And overall, I felt like, in many ways, she was more developed than Annie in this episode.
I will give you that, but she still felt like a plot device because she was just convenient to wherever the characters had to meet up. Oh, Vince Vaughn needs to go somewhere? I'll supply the safe house. Oh, Colin Farrell needs me to get Rachel McAdams onto the boat? Well, I technically owe him from exposition that we hadn't explained before. Like, it just felt so phony to me. And I know this is the most we've disagreed about an episode in so long, and yet I feel like we feel the exact same way about it, which is really hysterical to me.
I think we both agree that this was not a very good finale. I think I, overall, though, I like certain scenes a lot more than you, and I think that overall I like certain ideas, even though they were not executed very well. But I think it's clear we both agree, more than anything else, the way that Ray went out was really stupid.
So nonsensical.
Yeah. But any final thoughts before we move on to listener feedback?
I mean, I know a lot of people are going to say I'm being a negative Nancy and I'm whiny and whatever, but I just have to be honest. This did not work for me. It was not a very good season of television. And at 8.5 hours, that's a lot of time to invest into this season. Whether you take season one into context or not, on its own, I just did not find this to be a satisfying season of television. And I'm sorry. I feel terrible that I did not like it because I wanted to, but it just did not work for me.
Well, we're going to talk more about the season as a whole next week.
But, okay.
You know, a lot of people actually did not like this finale.
No, it's 29% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Even some people that I think were defending the season and were more on board with it than we have been as a whole did not like how it all turned out in the end. So clearly this has been a pretty divisive episode of television.
Also, one other thing. This being the finale, this does, unfortunately, I just saw the movie The Gift with Jason Bateman, where I loved the first 80 minutes and hated the last 10 minutes, so it soured the experience completely. The finale of a television show does impact the entire 8 hours that we've spent with these characters. Yes, it is just the ending, but it's the ending that leaves you going out on the story as a whole.
I agree, Charlie. That's why I hate it whenever I hear fans of Lost say, but it was all about the journey. It was all about the characters. And I want to strangle them and say, no, it wasn't. And even if it was, the ending ruined it. So,
yep. And honestly, I feel like it's easier to make that argument with film, that it was more about the journey than the conclusion. But with television, which is a big time commitment, this is 8.5 hours of screen time. I have to be harsh. I have to say this episode frustrated me and I wanted to like it. I like everybody involved in this television show. I didn't go in expecting to hate it. I was more optimistic about last episode than I have been in this season as a whole, and it just really felt like a huge letdown. And the reason I'm so angry is because I had, as you said, that slight bit of optimism towards the end of last episode that ended this episode.
All right. Well, we want to hear from our listeners. We are doing one more episode next week. We will be talking about the season as a whole, and we want to hear what you think. So if you want to leave us some feedback, you can email us at detectthis@filmgeekradio.com. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 336-793-2509. Please get in touch with us. We will happily talk about whatever you bring up, and we'll do our best to mention it on the show. We do read all the emails we get, even though we don't discuss every single email on the show, and we really appreciate the feedback. We've got one email to go over today. It's from our good friend Floyd, and he wrote us a lengthy email about some of his thoughts on the finale. I want to point out, though, what he says about the crow mask. Because I think, Charlie, you and I both agree that everything with Lenny was probably the weakest part of this episode. Well, that and Ray's death.
And the treatment of its female characters. But not to add insult to injury, but yeah.
But Floyd says, quote, "So, this all ended up just being a random mask that Lenny picked up after he tortured and killed Casper? Why in the hell would he have that with him in the car when he drove to dump Casper's body? Why in the hell would he have it and be wearing it when he shot Ray? I actually enjoy some red herrings because they keep you guessing. This was just too shoehorned into the story for me."
No, I agree. It's a weird red herring of what could that mean. It could have... And again, this goes back to... Remember in episode 2 where I said, oh, well, when Pitler had, like, the portrait of the bird that looked exactly like the bird mask in his office, that didn't pay off. But you know what? Sure, maybe I was looking too hard, but a set designer who worked on this show came up with that and thought, we should put this in his office. And maybe it was an accident? I don't know, but that
feels like a red herring
that feels like a cheat.
I don't know. That doesn't bother me too much, Charlie, because, and I do think that, you know, this is the type of show where many viewers are going to analyze every single frame. And that's fine. And that's wonderful.
And I was duped into that situation with that scene.
However, I think that the big issue here that Floyd has touched on with everything about the mask and, well, why does he have the mask with him? And why would he be wearing it when he shot Ray? The fact that when you have a plot this complex, you struggle so much to make everything connect within the time allotted that I think by design you're just going to have to gloss over certain details and just hope people don't notice and don't think about it too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think this season feels very messy. It's because there were so many different conspiracies that had to be unraveled and were intersecting with each other, that in order to connect it all together, you can't think too hard about the details of how it all works.
At the same time, it has no thematic weight. If it was a vulture mask, that would have been something else, because there had been vulture imagery. There was vulture imagery in a couple episodes ago around the scene where Tasha was murdered. There were vultures that were kind of picking at the blood that Vince Vaughn had, and whether that's in his mind or not remains up for debate, but that could at least be like, oh, it's society or the city is picking at their dead spirits or whatever. Like, I would have bought that. It would have at least been consistent to the bird imagery that we've seen. But this is a crow, and crows have not been, like, relative to the themes as a whole. It's like, oh, and Lenny didn't say, like, oh, I just went to the Halloween outlet and picked this up, which is what it feels like.
He took it off of Casper's wall.
Yeah, he took it off of Casper's wall for whatever reason, but it doesn't serve any symbolic meaning. And on top of that, we were talking about the possibilities of why did he shoot Ray with riot bullets. We didn't get any explanation to that. He just basically catches him and he's like, okay, you caught me. I guess I'll eavesdrop on this. We got no explanation as to what was going on, what his motive was for shooting Ray, why he used those bullets, why he left him there. It was just for convenient cliffhanger territory. You know, it was, and yeah, you're right, there's just, Nick Pizzolatto just bit off too much that he could chew for this season.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Floyd. I think that will wrap it up for this week's episode. Don't forget, we are recording one more episode, so True Detective might be over this season, but Detectives is not. So please write in. You can call us at 336-793-2509 and leave us a voicemail, or email us at detectives@filmgeekradio.com, or leave us a comment on the website at filmgeekradio.com. Please subscribe to the show through iTunes and Stitcher and write us a review. That really helps us out. We appreciate all of your support. And I don't want to harp on this too much because I don't like asking for money, but if you want to donate to us, we would really appreciate it. You just go to filmgeekradio.com, click the support tab and the donate button, or visit any of our affiliates, including Amazon, and we'll get a few pennies from them if you navigate to them through our website. Every little bit helps, and we really appreciate the support. It helps pay for our production costs. And, you know, we do this because we love it, and we put it out for free. So even if you just want to pay, like, 50 cents an episode and give us $5 just to show your appreciation, it really does help us out.
And every penny matters.
Yes, yes. But regardless, thank you so much for all your support. We hope you tune in next week for our final discussion on this season. Charlie, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at ctnash91. That's ctnash91. You can also find certain works I've written for Movie Mezzanine on moviemezzanine.com, Edge Media on edgemedianetwork.com, All Things Horror at allthingshorror.com, and Cinematic Essential at cinematicessential.com. And I really hope I haven't turned anyone off. I'm sorry that I'm as mad as I am. Please tune in next week and I'll be cooled down.
You know what, Charlie? If worse comes to worse, you'll just be like Lara Lynn in this episode playing to an empty
bar. That's another thing I forgot to bring up too. She apparently plays in the bar when it's closed and the seats are up on the tables and no one's there. Like, what?
Because she's lonely, Charlie, and all of her songs are about how desperate and depressed she is. But
anyways, as someone who suffers from depression and is lonely themselves, even that was too heavy-handed for me. So take with that what you will, listeners.
Well, you can find some of my writing at moviemezzanine.com and follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at WriterAndrew. If you do follow me, be sure to let me know you're a listener, and I'll do my best to follow you back. That'll wrap it up for this episode. I'm Andrew Johnson.
I'm Charlie Nash.
And honestly, Charlie, no one had a good view of this competition.
This has been a Film Geek Radio production.
Film Geek Radio!
Yeah.